Okay.
You are listening to the most original talk radio station anywhere. We are LA Talk Radio at latalkradio.com.
You're listening to Jack Marino, Warrior Filmmaker, right here on LA Talk Radio.
This is Jack Marino, ladies and gentlemen, your host of the Warrior Filmmaker Show on LATalkRadio.com, here in the heart of Hollywood. I'm broadcasting to you tonight live somewhere on Mulholland Drive, high in the Hollywood Hills, and not too far from that famous Hollywood sign. Sitting in my smoke-filled, dimly lit studio, I can see through the Venetian blinds the vast expanse of the City of Angels, with its millions upon millions of lights twinkling in the night sky. Make no mistake, each one of those lights comes with its very own story. In the dark canyon far below the studio is the former estate of legendary movie actor Errol Flynn. And that's one incredible story that never ends. So pull up your favorite chair, light up a smoke, pour yourself a drink, sit back, relax, and enjoy the show. Learn the truth of independent filmmaking, and because of politics of this town, one is treated like a fly buzzing around on a screen door on those hot LA days. Hear about those wild and woolly nights at the Garden of Allah, and of the Bundy Drive Boys and their wicked, wicked ways. Listen to my guests when they tell their stories of when the world was young, when they drank life like wine and lived like the wind. So take a trip with me now back in time to the golden era of Hollywood, where men were men and women were glamorous. A time when style meant class and doing the right thing was a way of life and virtue was its own reward. For this is Hollywood. This is the only place in the world that has the stuff that dreams are made of.
Well, hello everybody, this is Jack Marino, and we're back again here on a Friday night in the City of Angels, and I have a very special guest coming on, but I want to give out the phone numbers to the show. Anybody who would like to call and ask the questions, the phone number is 818-602-4929. That's 818-602-4929. My guest tonight is a writer, an author, and he wrote a book back in the 70s, which caught my eye as a young kid. And his name is John Hammond Moore. And John, I want to welcome you to the show.
Thank you.
John wrote a book called The Young Errol. So tonight will be about Errol Flynn. This good story goes back almost 100 years now, and but this is the life of Errol Flynn before he even set foot in America. This is the growing up in Australia, Tasmania, New Guinea, those that whole area, South Pacific, making his way over to Northampton, England, which basically was the stepping board to the United States. John, tell everybody how you came about to write this book, and you had told me before that you were assigned to go to Sydney or Melbourne to do a story. And before we go on, I just want to mention to everybody that John and I met John back, I think, around 2008, and we did a documentary. We were both interviewed in this documentary called The Tasmanian Devil, The Fast and Furious Life of Errol Flynn. So I had the opportunity to meet John, whose book I had purchased many years ago. So it was a treat to meet you that day and spend the day with you, you know.
Thank you.
Yeah, but so tell how this whole thing came about.
Well, in 1968, at that time I was a teacher, history professor, and I accepted a job at McClellan. Macquarie University, which is in Sydney. And after, I was there for 3 years, and I think probably the second year or so, I went up to New Guinea to attend a regional conference.
Wow.
And I had never heard much about Flynn, special interest in Flynn. And while I was up there in New Guinea, traveling around Port Moresby and so forth, I began to hear stories about him. And that's what interested me. And when I got back to Sydney, I started looking through the Sydney Morning Herald and back issues and so forth, and I eventually located several people who knew him very well. One guy was a guy named Ken Hunter Carr, who was particularly helpful. He was a little bit older than Sydney, than Arrow, but he was very instrumental in helping Arrow get settled into Sydney.
Right.
And get jobs and stuff like that. And he was not the only one. There were several other people who showed up who had intimate connections with him.
Right.
And that ended up as a book, yes.
Yeah. And when you were in Papua New Guinea, what kind of stories did you hear?
Oh, all sorts of things. But usually it was that he was up in that area for about, off and on for about 4 or 5 years, from about 1936 through... early 40s.
Yeah, no, 26. He was in 1926.
Yeah, 26, excuse
yeah,
me.
Yeah.
And he had many jobs and moved around frequently. Often he didn't live up to what the job wanted. Wasn't. Sometimes he ran off with money and stuff like that. It's not a very happy story.
No, I know, I know.
But he was moving fast.
Yeah, he was moving fast, and he had to live by his wits, especially in the jungle. And but going back to his early days in school when he was a young boy, you know, what did you find out? Because he lived in many places. His mother and father moved around, and their relationship, their marriage wasn't too happy.
No, the problem was Daddy had gotten the job. His father had gotten the job teaching at the University of Tasmania, and both of mother and father had grown up, lived in Sydney area in a metropolitan setting, and they didn't like Hobart. They didn't like it at all. That's where Arrow was born in 1909.
Right.
And in other words, I just wanted to understand him. One of the first things is he had this very unhappy home life where parents were not living together much of the time. Mother was off in Europe traveling around with friends, and his father was frequently hunting for another job, and eventually he did get one and landed a job in Ireland.
Right.
So, the first clue to his personality is the fact that he had a very unhappy home life. He was transferred from one school to both public and private schools off and on until, like, the last school was in Sydney when he was about 16. He got kicked out of there because he was caught on the coal pile with the daughter of the laundress. That was his last... I think he was... almost 17 when that occurred. That was the end of his school career.
And he was a pretty big, you know, for his age. He was a tall, good-looking kid.
Yeah, and this is the second thing you have to understand about him was those good looks. Ken Hunter Carr said it was embarrassing just to walk down the street with him as he got older, and he had so much attention from other people.
Yeah,
from particularly, and of course, as we know, he tried to use that attention in later life.
Right. Well, he just...
Yeah. He's a man, too.
Yeah. But you had said that... You had told me once that... Because I asked you a question a long time ago. I remember that... you know, that Errol ever dream of being a movie star or Hollywood or anything like that, thinking that he's so far away on the other side of the world. And he was a big film buff. He did go see the silent movies with John Barrymore. And that's where I think he became enamored with Barrymore.
Yes.
As a young kid, as all of us did with him, you know, watching him in his movies. You had mentioned that somewhere in his younger days, he made up his mind he was going to be a movie actor. He was going to be an actor. So
that developed in Sydney, I think.
Yeah.
Not in Papua New Guinea. No, that was
when he was in. Home as a young boy, because he used to live with her mother, his grandmother, or his mother?
Hey, pardon?
When the parents would take off, who was he staying with? Was he in school?
He had two grandmothers lived right. in Sydney.
Okay.
So he could stay with one or the other.
Right. So they both were there, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's been a while since I read your book, and I got to get the new, because you added a new addendum to the book.
Yes, it's just a small postscript. Yeah.
Right. And anybody wants to check out where John's books are, go to Amazon.com under John Hammond Moore, under books, and you got about 2 pages of books there. I mean, you've written a lot of books on... there's one book called The Southern Home Front, The Plantation
yes.
Mistress, The Carnival of Blood, which is dueling, lynching, murder in South Carolina, When the South Was an Armed Camp, which that's the book I recently received. Thank you very much. And The South...
That's the latest one.
Yeah,
that's the Armed Camp's the latest one, yeah.
That's going to be interesting. And you got the South Carolina Highway Department between 1917 and 78, must be interesting. And then the Confederate Housewife, which should be...
That is a collection of recipes published during the Civil War.
Wow. And then you did Fossball, was it? Fossball Turner? Tunnel?
Fossball Tunnel.
Fossball Tunnel.
German, Fissball, German for soccer.
Oh, okay.
The stories of the POWs who were here during World War II.
And they had, and there was their great escape.
Well, they tried. There was a group in a camp in southern Arizona who tried to dig a tunnel. Well, they dug a tunnel anyway.
Yeah.
And tried to escape to Mexico. They thought they'd have a better chance there. They didn't make it.
They didn't make it.
They got out of the tunnel, okay, but they didn't get to Mexico.
Yeah. That's because they didn't have Steve McQueen in
there. And I went to Germany and interviewed some of them. That's how I got my story.
Oh, that's a great story, yeah. And a lot of people don't know that, because we had POW camps in this country for Germans and Japanese and Italians up in this.
What happened was really the Axis collapsed in North Africa before we had any place to put them in. We had no holdings in. England couldn't take care of them, and we didn't have any place in Europe to put them, and we had empty ships coming back from sending supplies across the Atlantic, so why not bring them over here?
Right.
So roughly, I don't know, 500,000 came over here.
Wow.
The Italians were the particular special problem, because Italy changed size in the middle of the war, and what do you do with...
A lot of them stayed in New York and New Jersey. They never went back.
Yeah. Well, a lot of them did. They couldn't stay. They had to go home.
Yeah.
And then they could come back legally, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of them did. But, getting back to Errol, his relationship with his mother was constant. She was constantly on his back.
Yes. When she was there.
Yeah. Well, he was interfering, with her. She was a social butterfly, And she...
Definitely.
Yeah. And so anything he did wrong, would magnify for her. And, and he was a very... Like Jeffrey Myers says, he was a naughty little boy, he was caught with a couple of girls growing up.
Yes.
Yeah.
When he was very young, yes. And she apparently, according to one of his friends, he told him later that for a year or two after that, sometimes she only called him a little pig. She wouldn't use his real name.
Yeah. Well, again, that was a whole different era.
But she's the one that bought him the yacht. Later,
the
just sort of surprising.
His mother?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought it was his grandmother that bought it.
No, his mother bought it. Yeah.
Now, what was that in the story? Because years later, Errol, as we know, wrote his his biography with Earl Conrad, and it was it's a fun read, and it's very funny. And but talk about where you have his mother buys him the original Scirocco. That he goes, mm-hmm. He takes up to the Great Barrier Reef, and then I think Errol Flynn, he told the story he wanted gambling or something. If I remember the story, I don't know. It's been so long.
Something like that. Yeah. He didn't want to give his mother credit for much of anything.
It was either a fist fight he wanted in or gambling somewhere in a bar or someplace. So. But he always embellished, the autobiography is just, like I said, it's a fun read. And then, you wrote The Young Errol and you laid it all out. No, it was very simple. His mother bought the boat, and then him and the other three guys took off to up the Great Barrier Reef. Now,
yes.
Explain, people don't realize how big that area is. And you've got four young kids, because Flynn had to be... Oh, I don't remember now. I think he's going to be 19 to 20 years old, I think, right? And
about that, yeah.
Yeah, and none of them knew how to sail a boat. and it wasn't really a big boat, And they took it up the Great Barrier Reef. So explain some of the adventures he went on that, on that journey.
Well, I don't know if I can remember specific adventures, but the whole thing was an adventure, for God's sake.
Right. Well, I remember that, he used to, because they would run out of food and stuff, so in order for them to get money, Flynn would go into a bar.
Yeah.
And basically say, I got $100 here or something, $50, and I says, I'll beat anybody in the room for, a double the bet or whatever.
Yeah.
And he had no money on him.
Yeah.
And, he'd give the guy a beat and they'd collect the money and they'd go take off.
Take off, yeah. Yes, definitely.
Yeah. And, it's just, again, and then when Flynn tells a story, I mean, it's, he's not fighting one guy, he's fighting like 12 guys, I mean, it's just the way he tells everything, so it's a fun read. The story, when Errol, when he's in Australia, before he takes off to New Guinea, when does he get the diamonds? Was that up in...
After he'd made his premier movie, Charles Sauvel, the director, his wife got a call from a very wealthy woman in town, and in Errol's book, he calls her Madge Parks, but I could never locate her exactly, but she was wealthy, and she was going to give a party, and she called the studio, and Good Days Supply, a bunch of young people to jazz up the party.
Okay.
And so Errol went to the party, and he ended up in bed with Madge, and she was asleep, and he stole her jewels. And that is how he got the money to get to England.
So that was the money to England, okay. That's another thing. We've got to talk about going up the... Flynn was working in New Guinea, and he was on the Septic River, and Cheval had seen him or something, or was he... they had taken some...
No, Cheval saw him at the beach in Sydney.
Okay.
And he was thinking of making this movie, and he said, there's Fletcher Christian. The movie was The Wake of the Bounty.
Right.
And that's how he got the part.
And the funny thing is, a lot of people don't know that Flynn's mother's ancestor was Midshipman Young on the Bounty.
Yeah, he had definite ties to the Bounty, and when he got to Hollywood... and started talking about it, everybody thought it was another one of his lies.
Yeah. But he actually...
He did have family connections. In fact, one of his cousins whom I interviewed had a picture of the Bounty framed over his mantle and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
But there was a connection.
I had read there was two brothers, young brothers, and... I forget which one was on the Bounty, whether Mary Lillie was a descendant of the actual midshipman or the brother that was in Australia at the time. So they were both sailors, in the British Navy. So, but that's going way back. But it's interesting because he always claimed he had the sword of Fletcher Christian, So
yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. But there's been so many stories about him. Now, in one of the documentaries, there's a couple of Errol's schoolgirl classmates, And did you ever interview any of his classmates from one of the schools he was in?
No, I don't think I may have. I don't know.
Yeah.
It would be down in Hobart.
Right. Right.
I poked around with people down there, but I don't remember any class. Yes, I did, yes. They remembered some of the stories about him, yes.
Right, right. And, well, I got a bunch of questions some of the Flynn fans wanted me to ask you. From the Errol Flynn blog, Dave DeWitt's blog, and it's errolflynnblog.com. And this is from Tim Reed, and he writes about the 75th anniversary of Robin Hood this year, and he said, is there any evidence that you saw, researching your book, how much of Robin Hood do you believe Errol was born with, or did he develop this in his youth?
Born with? Let's see. What?
Because they always said, he was born to play Robin Hood.
I don't know about that.
Yeah.
He did it, and he did it well.
Yeah.
But I can't answer that direct. I don't quite get it.
Yeah.
Well, I guess you could say later in life, yes, he was born to play Robin Hood.
Right. And he said this evidence includes part of your passages regarding recollections of his classmate Bill Penfold at Shore Sydney Church England Grammar School.
Yes.
And Arrow's own account having knockdown brawl with a school bully named Lindsay in My Wicked Wicked Ways. So where's the truth? Somewhere in there is the truth.
Right. One of his teachers at Shore later said that whenever he was talking about his career, he mentioned that he had as students two murderers and Errol Flynn.
he was always in the middle of something.
But his record is completely erased at the school. They published a list of all the students, and when you entered that school, Church of England School, wasn't far from where I lived in Sydney, when you entered that school, you were given a number. His number is gone. His name is gone. It's not there.
Yeah. Interesting. I wonder why they did that. Because,
I think you can answer that.
Yeah. Well, in Sydney and Hobart right now, there's like four or five houses he moved around in his family, and they're all there. I mean, all the houses are there, and there's a couple, Steve and Janine, they have it on their website, and they have these little Errol Flynn tours. They take you around the city where he went to school, the beach that he hung out at, and everything,
They didn't have a tour for me when I was there.
They started this... about 10, 12 years ago.
The houses are there.
The house is the house that he tried to burn down in the cellar. And the beams are still charred. They can still see them.
Because one thing to understand about it, one thing to understand about Errol is the fact that it is a very wrecked home life that he had to grow up with.
Yeah.
With both of the parents trying to be someplace else.
Right. Yeah,
his mother apparently was running around with the Aga Khan.
Yeah.
Around Europe with the Aga Khan at one point.
Wow. Well, the thing is, they both abandoned his... he's 16 years old, okay? And he's in an area of Australia. It's like the Wild West, in the 1800s. And he's a 16-year-old kid, and they abandoned him,
Pretty much.
Yeah, I don't think they left him any money.
They didn't have that much money, no.
Yeah. So he went to live with his grandmother. I mean,
yeah.
There's not a lot of material to read about how she was. I think she couldn't probably control him. He was 16 at the time. I think he was close to 6 feet tall then.
Yeah.
What I read, he was embarrassed that he had no money because he hung out with a lot of rich kids.
Yes, he got mixed up. That was one of the real problems. He got mixed up with a very wealthy group. In fact, he got engaged to one of the girls, and he didn't have the money to keep up with them.
Yeah. And that leads you to do things. Little petty larceny here and there,
Yeah, and that's how he lost one or two of his jobs.
Yeah.
Probably more than that.
Let me see. Another fellow named Les Chrisley, he writes, how long did it take you, he says, how long did it take you to do research of all the great stories in the life of Errol Leslie Flynn?
Let's see. Probably about 5 years.
Wow.
Something like that.
How many people?
Let's see. When did I left Australia in 70. When did the book come out? Just 2 or 3 years, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then, did you finish it here in the States, or did you finish it there?
Yes. No, here.
So you did all your legwork and interviews down there and came home and put it all together, yeah.
When I got up here, I was living in Washington, and I could go to the Library of Congress and use their resources and check the newspapers and so forth.
Right. And, okay, let me see what we got here. And a Harry Wilton. Sounds like someone's knocking on my window here. I'm on the second floor. What was the fireworks? There's fireworks going on here. Oh. Okay, we're going to be having some fireworks over here.
Okay.
Yeah, he questions Madge Parks, the wealthy married woman who Errol had an affair with in 32 in Sydney, describes the affair in his book, Wicked, Wicked Ways. So you had just mentioned that. And then Errol's friends staff, the Wake of the Bounty, John Warwick, appears to have provided you with information on your book. Did John tell you the identity of Madge?
No.
Okay.
No, I never could trace that down.
Yeah. Okay, and no one, because you said that, no one, and then there's Stephen Yorkin. Stephen wrote, let me see, did you gather information from any of the newspapers in New Guinea at the time?
There was only one, maybe Papua New Guinea,
Yeah.
Sure. Whatever I could find.
Was there a lot of stuff about him in the papers?
No, not a great deal, no. Not at that time.
Because you were there in 68, 69, so
yeah.
He was only dead for 10 years.
Yeah.
And he died at 50, so most of his friends were probably in their late 50s, early 60s when you were there.
Yeah.
You know. So there was still a lot of people. And did you get to meet any of the guys who that were on the Sirocco with him?
Don't think so. Let's see. I don't think so.
Because there's a story. I think the guy, Charlie, well, I couldn't think of his name. He was in the Australian Navy. And he was telling all his friends, you know, in the Australian Navy. And he said, oh, no, Errol Flynn and I are good friends. And this is when Errol was shooting the movie Dive Bomber.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently, his ship got into San Diego, and Flynn happened to be shooting Dive Bomb in San Diego. And when Charlie found out about it, he went down to the set and brought all his Australian buddies there. And when Flynn saw him, Flynn just went crazy, you know, gave him a hug. And, you know, so his mates basically just couldn't believe it because they thought he was pulling their leg, you know.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think Flynn took him around for a couple of days, you know. And
yeah.
They had a great time. So a friend of mine told me that story. He had actually contacted this guy Charlie, who was one of the guys in the boat on that first trip up the Great Barrier Reef. You know.
Yeah.
And this one of the fans. Her name is Igna, and she writes. Did you ever work on the New Guinea diary? Have you ever seen it? Do you know where it may be?
No, it was in the book. I explained it disappeared.
It disappeared. Okay.
No, it was in the papers that the Innes family found it in their material, and they tried to give it back to him when they were in Hollywood in the 30s, and they couldn't get to him, and it's since disappeared apparently.
Yeah. Now I had a lot of papers and letters from Flynn's days in New Guinea. Now they were mostly letters to his father.
Mm-hmm.
And I got them from Tony Thomas, who got them from Earl Conrad.
Right.
And Earl Conrad got them from Flynn when they were working down in Jamaica on the book.
Yeah.
So Tony would give them to me. What happened? The way the trail was, Flynn gave them to Earl. Earl gave them to Trudy McVicker. Trudy McVicker came to Tony. You know, here I am, a kid from Burbank over here. And I got him. So,
good for you.
Yeah.
Good for you.
So, you know, I've made copies, and everybody has copies of him. So it's interesting how he writes. He's a young kid in the middle of the jungle in New Guinea. He's trying to run this copra plantation.
Right. Tobacco,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he, he talks about God. He talks about he's trying to find his faith. And, you know, Lincoln did a lot of research. You remember meeting Lincoln Hurst.
Yes.
And Lincoln found through all of Flynn's writing, he had this fascinating about Christianity and wanted to find out the exact truth. He was looking for that one answer to basically make him believe everything. So he couldn't ever find it, you know. But here he was reading the Bible in New Guinea. He took it with him to Hollywood. I mean, even John Huston, when they're in Africa, Flynn is shooting Roots of Heaven, and he's sitting there reading the Bible.
one of the questions that keep coming up with Flynn, and Louis de Havilland asked it, and his father did the same thing when he was talking to Conrad about finishing touches to Wicked Wicked Ways, and they both were trying to figure out what makes him tick.
Yeah.
What motivates him? And there's no answer.
No.
But you're getting close when you talk about the religious.
Yeah.
At least there's a trail there.
Right. Well, you know, Pat Wymore is down in Jamaica, and she told Lincoln had gone down to Jamaica with Deirdre, and the three of them sat there for a couple of days. You know, they would meet at the hotel, and Lincoln was always throwing questions at her. And he asked her about that, because that was one big thing Lincoln was trying to put together in his book. And she said that he would walk around with this little pocket Bible. And if he met a Catholic priest or a rabbi or a reverend, he would pull out this little book and read and says, "Now, what does that mean? Tell me what that means, you know." So he was like, she said he was always just searching for that one answer.
Mm-hmm.
To tie it all together, you know, to convince him. And he was always, you know, but I think that one answer is faith. That's all you can say.
Yeah,
you know?
I'm afraid so.
Yeah, but when did he, you know, because we're going to keep talking. I'm not going to go to commercials. We're going to keep talking.
Right.
When he left for New Guinea, okay, when he left to go to New Guinea, where was the time period that he actually met Dr. Urban, Herbin Urban?
Well, Urban is a very confusing character.
Right.
Because it appears on different names. But that was, that would have been after the Sirocco trip, I think.
Right.
Yeah. The first time he went up there, at that time, in his first trip up, he stayed in various places. There's New Ireland, New Britain, and New Guinea, and he was on all three places.
Right.
And floating around very fast. But in the second trip, he was a tobacco grower, and this was after the Sirocco trip.
Right.
And he was much more subtle the second time.
Right. Now, what time did he get involved with that that story where he actually shot the native? Is that a true story?
I don't think so. Was that when he was supposedly suppressing an outbreak of several natives? I think that's the story that happened to somebody else, and he was very good at picking up other people's stories and putting them into his own life.
Yeah. Well, he was supposedly, you know, the rumors were, or what he said, that he was recruiting native labor for the British, which they call blackbirding.
Yeah, he did do that. That's
okay.
True.
Okay,
but that the incident of that eruption of gunfire and so forth, that happened to somebody else, not him.
So,
But he just picked it up and put it in his story.
Yeah, and then because he said he was tried for first-degree murder and he was acquitted.
Yeah.
So that's all, basically.
I don't think that's true. No. he just liked, whenever he had to do any writing, he wanted to make a good story out of it.
Yeah, he was an Irishman. That's what he was.
Okay. And he picked up stories from other friends.
Yeah.
He used them.
Well, the thing is, I mean, here he is in Hollywood telling these stories. I mean, I read stuff where John Barrymore would just stare at him with a notched eyebrow and just say, because Barrymore was a spinner of tales himself, you know.
Okay.
And Flynn, would he just outdo them all, you know. They didn't know what to believe. So, but yeah, he was up there, and that's where he caught malaria. And
yes.
Up in that area.
There were no hospitals up there, and any time he became ill from malaria or VD or anything, he had to go back to Sydney.
Yeah. What was that quote from his father?
Hey, Fred.
His father wrote him a letter, and he says, it's something about sleeping with native women. He says, you stink in the nostrils of white men or something.
Yes.
And he wrote back, Dear Dad, I stink. But yeah, he had, I read he had a rare form of gonorrhea.
Yeah,
from New Guinea, so, mm-hmm. And he left New Guinea when he was what? He had to be in this 1931.
Let's see. Yeah. No, not quite that old. He was born in 1909. He left there in the early 20s, in the early 30s.
Right. So
yeah, you're right.
Yeah, it was around that time. I don't have the specific date. But it was that trip. That's when he met Urban, and then they decided to go to England. But do you remember what the journey was? Because they supposedly got involved with the China War that was going on at the time. There was
China War. I was
reading that him and Urban, they signed up for something, and they got called into this. I don't know if it was near Hong Kong or someplace. It was in Indochina.
Yeah, yeah.
And they deserted to get on another ship. In other words, they jumped from ship to ship, you know.
Yeah. The urban story is very confusing because it's not clear who it was exactly.
Yeah. So
the name changes with various editions and so forth.
Right. But Urban supposedly followed him all the way to Marseille.
Yeah,
and then Flynn went on to Paris.
Well, there was one instance where they were trying to go to Madrid, I think.
Right.
Which was when our government didn't like that.
Right.
They didn't want it mixed up in the Spanish Civil War.
Right. And but Flynn had gone on to he went on to Paris, and you know the story is that he met Lily Demeter on the boat, the Queen Mary. Coming to America, and
right.
I have found out that they met in Paris, and she was a major movie star.
Yeah,
and she was married to supposedly Michael Curtiz, but at that time I don't think she was. I think she was divorced from him, but she was a big French star, working in American films, and they met somewhere. I mean, I don't know where, in a nightclub or someplace, but you know, they had an affair, and then they both went. They both went to England. She went to London, and he went to Northampton. So, because there is a letter that when he got to Northampton, he's 24 at the time, and I had the letter in my hand because Lincoln had all seven letters, because he only wrote seven letters to Urban in his whole life. And on this letter, and I think maybe... Tom McNulty may have a copy of this letter, or Dave DeWitt. But he actually is very prophetic, because he talks about to Urban, I'm here in London, I'm going to try out for the Northampton Repertory Theatre in the morning. I'm going to get a job working here. I'm going to become an actor. I'm going to marry a French actress. He predicts everything. go to Hollywood. Yeah, I mean, it was like one paragraph. He basically outlined his whole life. Mm-hmm. And it happened exactly the way he wrote it. It's remarkable. I mean, this is before he even got hired to be an actor at the Northampton Repertory Theater.
Yeah.
You know? Now, he spent about a year. Did you do any research on his time there in London, in England?
Very little, no. I didn't, not too much.
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead. Excuse me. I can't think of anything else right now.
Because in Northampton, years later, a friend of mine who worked on my film, his mother dated Flynn that year. And Flynn was proposed to get married, and the father said no. And I don't know if he was still seeing Lily Demeter going to London to see Lily, and he proposed marriage to this young actress. But that was my friend Peter's mother.
Mm-hmm.
And so Flynn knew her for about a year or so, and because later on in life, Peter named one of his sons Errol. But she married a Jewish fella, Weisberg, Max Weisberg, who I've met Max, and he's passed away now, but he was working for the, I think, Polish underground. He got captured, was in Auschwitz. He escaped from Auschwitz. The British commandos got him. They put him back in there to get information. It's an incredible story, and he gets out again. That's an incredible story. And his wife was dating Errol Flynn.
There was a guy in England who did some research on that period in his life, and I mention it in my book. I can't remember his name offhand.
Yeah,
but he's published on what he was doing at Northampton and stuff like that.
Yeah. There's a couple books on him in Northampton, and there's a book on Urban. Bill Donati did a book with Buster, and he spent. I think Bill was over there for 2 or 3 weeks staying with Urban and getting a lot of information about him. But there's this guy, Stroiber, who wrote a book, which Trudy was translating because it was written in German. And he said that, Stroiber was a really rotten guy. I mean, he hated Errol Flynn. And so his point of view of Flynn, you think he was, he was with that whole thing that Haim published, which is a lie, but because even Urban denies everything, he said it's not true, and but you read about Urban's life. I mean, he's a Jewish guy in the Nazi Party, and he used to dress up as Hitler.
Mm-hmm.
It's bizarre. I mean, the guy was really bizarre. So I mean, Flynn was attracted to these type of people, even in Hollywood. You know, he was just he just like hanging out with weirdos, and crazy people.
Okay.
So, but anyways, what did you find in your research, one of the biggest, the biggest embellishment in Wicked, Wicked Ways that you found in your research in The Young Errol? Anything that...
Come again, I don't quite understand.
In other words, this simple little story that happened to Flynn, and then when Flynn, by the time he writes his memoirs, he turns it into this big, big, epic story, really embellishes this big, like I said, when he bought the boat, he was supposed to win it gambling, and his mother bought it out. See, I had read this, his grandmother bought the boat, so I mean...
No, his mother.
His mother, yeah.
Which was something of a surprise too, but
yeah,
that was she and her and his father, and this is a wonderful phrase for them to use, but they thought it was time for Errol to get into something,
right?
And they meant a job, of course,
right? Get a career, right? Yeah,
yeah, and that's what they were worried about.
Yeah, because he wasn't he was jumping around from thing, Whatever tickled his fancy, he jumped into it, And,
right.
He was the British. He was playing the. I forget. He called it a cop, but it wasn't. It was. He was in. Was it the shipping job? He had the. He was working for the British. It was the clerk.
Yeah.
So it's been.
See, one of the problems. At one point, he got a very respectable position. His very first position up in New Guinea. Somebody had not shown up to become a patrol officer, and he became a patrol officer.
Right, that's the job.
Until his record caught up with him, and so he lost the job almost immediately.
Yeah, but you know, that
patrol officer was a white guy who lived among the natives and tried to straighten them out.
Right,
that sort of thing.
And there was, you know, when he was in New Guinea, Errol used to do a lot of writing, and some of his writings were printed in the paper.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where, you know, Tony Thomas would tell me, that's where he really started to learn how to write.
Yes.
And
the reports that he issued in the Sydney Bulletin are pretty good stuff. And in those days, breaking into the Bulletin was top drawer.
Really? Yeah.
Really, very impressive.
So that's good. Because that's, you know, he's sitting there alone. He did a lot of reading.
Yeah.
And he would write. And, I mean, fortunately, I was very lucky to get a couple of, you know, a lot of his letters and stuff and some of his papers from Tony, and he's a very insightful guy, and he's just, you know, he's just a young kid, and he's hungry to learn, he's hungry to do something, you know, you can tell, and
well, he was a very bright guy.
Yeah. He just, like Tony used to say, well, he just wasn't disciplined. He said if he had the discipline, he would have been right. You know?
Well, that's true.
You know, but, you know, his books, Beam's End is a great book, you know, and Showdown. He got some great reviews on Beam's End when he wrote that in 37.
Yeah.
You know, that's a fun book. I mean, it's sort of the trip up the, with his buddies up the Great Barrier Reef. But,
right.
You know, his little stories and the stuff that he used to write for the Sydney Times was pretty good. It was, you could see there was a making of a guy that really wanted to be a writer, you know.
And, yeah.
You know, and the thing with him was, you know, when he became famous, you know, Hollywood, there's so many distractions here. You know, I mean, women being the biggest part of it, but you know, just hanging out with the guys and partying and making movies, and it's just, you know, you really have to. I mean, you know what it takes to be a writer, so you can't have these kind of distractions in your life, you know.
I agree.
Yeah. So, but how did you find, when you were down in Australia, what did you think of all the places down there? I mean, I've never been there, so what's it, when you got to see some of the areas or some of the people that he knew, you know, what was running through your mind at that time as far as,
and Sydney's a lovely place to live, and there's a nice beaches and all that sort of stuff, and a very nice climate.
Right.
It doesn't get as hot as our West Coast, or as cool. And what can I say? And then, well, in connection with this and other research, I did a lot of traveling up to Townsville and interviewed people there up the coast. It's a nice area.
Yeah. And what do you think? Would you think of Hobart? Did you ever get to Hobart?
Yes, I did. When I was doing research, I did get to Hobart, and it is it's a long way down there.
It is, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it is.
Well, Tasmania is a separate island, of course. It's a state, but it is very separate from the rest of the country.
Right.
And somewhat isolated as a result of that.
It is. And supposedly his father was with Shackleton when they took that trip to the South Pole.
Yes.
And he was gone for a long time, so. Yeah, and did you ever get to meet Errol's sister, Rosemary? I mean, it was...
Yes. I interviewed her and had dinner with her and met her socially and so forth.
Wow.
But she didn't know much about him.
Really?
Didn't know any more than what she read in the newspapers because she was 10 years younger than he was.
Right, he was gone.
And she was off in Europe with her mother.
Yeah. What was she like? I mean, did she look like...
No.
Nothing?
Didn't know she... Well, she looked something like him, but it wasn't as good... It didn't come off as well in a woman.
Yeah.
Looked like something like him, yes.
Yeah. No, did
she? She has since died.
Oh, yes, she has. Been, yeah. So is her husband. Her husband was in the military. I think he was in a...
Yes, he was, yeah.
He was a military career guy. I think he was a colonel or something.
Yeah.
But, yeah, you don't see too many pictures of Rosemary, and she kept the... Because she lived in Washington for many years, years later. You know.
Yeah. That's where I knew her, in Washington.
Yeah. And... Did she have any? Did she ever show you any correspondence with him, or letters, or anything? Or
no,
nothing.
No, I don't think she had much contact with him.
Wow, that's incredible. Because it was just them two. But that it happens in all the families. Well, John, listen, I got the wave off, and I want to thank you for coming on the show.
Okay, enjoyed it.
Yeah, and it was fun, and I'll have you back on. We'll talk about some of these books in the Civil War. I'm a big Civil War buff.
Okay, be happy to try it.
Yeah, we'll try it, and let me read a couple of these things, and I'll get back to you. So.
Okay.
And but again, thanks for coming on, and I really, I had a good time with you that day we shot on the DVD with all those guys from Australia, and and I was very happy to take you around. I mean, thank God we had some time to take up Mulholland and take up a few places. You know, it was fun.
Enjoyed it.
Yeah. All right then, John, I'll be talking to you.
Thanks very much.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, well, that's Mr. John Hammond Moore, and I hope we got some information out there. It's a lot to cover, but in an hour. Anyways, I'll be back next week, and I hope everybody has a great week, and I'll see you then.
You're listening to Jack Marino, Warrior Filmmaker, right here on LA Talk Radio.